story about a little guy that lives in a blue world. And all day and all night and everything he sees is just blue, like him inside and outside. Blue his
heart. Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS political newsletter. I'm Kyle Mullian, joined by Adrian Heeman from Grassroots Midwest. Thanks for joining me, Adrian.
Thanks a lot, Kyle. Always a pleasure to be here.
So a little later, we're going to have your alum joining us on the program, Josh Pugh, for Our Future. He's going to be talking about the future of that Tom Steyer-funded group, and they're not going away. And what are they going to be doing? Well, we're going to find out in just a little bit. But first, Adrian, we had an election on Tuesday, and we had some successes for Democrats, particularly on the statewide ticket. Is it fair to call it a blue wave?
Absolutely. I think it's fair to call it a blue wave in Michigan and across the country. Every Democrat who was listed on the ballot as a Democrat statewide in Michigan won last Tuesday. That's remarkable. The Democrats, even though these are quote-unquote nonpartisan elections, they also flipped a state Supreme Court seat. Justice Curtis Wilder's not coming back in January. They flipped two county commissions, the Oakland County Commission and the Eaton County Commission, two growing suburban counties where Republicans have traditionally done very well. You know, at a state level, there's no question that this was a blue wave. You know, nationally, the Democrats racked up wins all up and down the ballot. The Affordable Care Act, three different Medicaid expansions passed in very bright red states, Idaho, Utah, and Nebraska. You know, you lost two Republican congressmen in Texas, even though Beto O'Rourke lost his Senate bid. There's not a Republican judge left come January in Harris County, Texas. There's some remarkable wins up and down the ballot for Democrats.
So if the Democrats did so well, why do we still have a 4-3 majority Republican-nominated justices on our Supreme Court, and the Senate and the House are still Republican here in the state?
Well, so the Supreme Court thing's a little bit different because those are quote-unquote nonpartisan races. I don't think that the Bagenstos campaign did enough to communicate with Democratic voters that he was the Democratic choice. I think Beth Clement did a very good job running her campaign, even though the Republicans ran away from her. At the state legislative level, as much as there's a temptation to lay that at the feet of gerrymandering, partisan redistricting, whatever you want to call it, and I do think that that played some sort of role, there were also some real missed opportunities for Democrats down ballot. Particularly, you think about in Oakland County. Having your nominee in the 39th House District up on felony charges was poison, not just for winning that race. The Democrats also lost the 15th Senate District race there, which was a very winnable race. Republicans came in with late money for Jim Runstead there. The Democratic brand was suffering some real damage from Jenny Swedan being up on felony charges. There were a couple of other close elections that they lost in Oakland County as well. You know, and in the Senate, at a certain point, it just came down to resources. I mean, they picked up five seats. It's the most since Watergate. They did not have the resources, the Senate Democrats, to compete in enough seats to be able to flip the majority there. I think that there's some missed opportunities, really, in the House. The Senate, there's just no way they were going to have enough money to win nine seats.
I mean, also, Adrian, you've got to recognize that we're still balkanized as a state, right? And the fact is that the Democratic brand still just doesn't work still north of Clare. You still have some problems in Macomb County. So, I mean, Trump is still popular in those areas. And as long as Trump is still popular in those areas, they're going to win those seats. Monroe, I think you can also add to that equation. So it's difficult, even with a lot of money. I'm not sure if the Democrats win those seats.
Yeah, there's a formula that works there, but simply bashing the president obviously is not a winning formula there. It's true that there's some realignment going on in the electorate around Michigan in certain areas, but it's possible to win for Democrats in areas where the president's popular. Democrats flipped two congressional seats in upstate New York where the president was polling plus 10 in terms of favorability. It's very possible to do that. Sherrod Brown won his reelection in Ohio going away in a state that Trump won by a good margin where he's still pretty popular. So there's a formula that works there, but simply bashing the president is not what gets that done. But you're right. Northern Michigan is kind of a wasteland for Democrats right now. I mean, really, come January 1st, the only thing that they're going to hold is the 109th House seat centered on the city of Marquette. Obviously, in addition to the traditional union presence in the UP there, you've got all those university employees as well, which really helps Democrats a lot.
So what's going on in Ottawa County and Livingston County? Livingston County didn't show up for Bishop like they had in years past, so he lost. And then in Ottawa County, understand that a Democrat actually won a race.
Yeah, that's right. There's a couple of things going on there. Part of it is this realignment we keep talking about, where college-educated voters, particularly college-educated women, are fleeing the Republican Party in droves. That's particularly true in suburban areas. One of the other things that's very interesting is the sort of religious divide in some of this. I think that that sort of points the way to some opportunities. You know, the Catholics are also fleeing the Republican brand in droves now that Donald Trump's our president. Evangelicals have been with him steady there. You know, you look at places like Oakland County and Eaton County in particular, there's a lot of my tribe, right? A lot of Catholics in those two counties. Ottawa's a little bit of an outlier in that regard, in that, you know, the new county commissioner from the city of Holland has got a nice Dutch last name and is a CRC person.
Okay.
But with the exception of that one seat in Ottawa County, I think that's a lot of what you're seeing, is that realignment sorting itself out by college education and by religion.
Well, and I was also going to point, in that Holland district, Rob Davidson was a heck of a candidate. And I know the Democrats put a lot of attention there. He clearly didn't win. And to beat Bill Heisinger was going to be very, very difficult in that area. But the very fact that they were even putting any attention there at all, I found was remarkable.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that points to part of the way forward for Democrats is being really strategic about trying to compete in areas that are trending your way, even if you're not going to win there. That's not to say you should be making massive investments in that. And a lot of the Democratic interest groups passed on Dr. Rob Davidson, but he ran as good a campaign as he could have. Mm-hmm. And that seems to have had some down ballot effects. But you're seeing Democrats start to do this in some areas that have traditionally been Republican and are sort of fleeing the Republican brand. You saw some of that with Democrats trying to compete in some county commission seats in Livingston County, really trying to organize around the city of Howell and the city of Brighton, which are on point with the realignment from a geographic perspective, and certainly, especially in the case of Brighton, from a college education perspective. So I think that that's pretty smart football from the Democrats.
I don't think there's an area in the state, though, that took a harder left turn than Kalamazoo. And for Kalamazoo to just basically bury Margaret O'Brien, who's had as productive of a year as any state senator I think we've seen in several years, and then to give Fred Upton a scare on election night, I think was extremely remarkable.
I think that's right. And I think your guest who's following after me deserves a fair amount of credit for that in his team at For Our Future. Some other Democratic aligned interest groups, there was a concerted effort made to turn out college students and younger voters in the city of Kalamazoo, especially. And you see that reflected in the results. Like you said, yeah. Fred Upton got a scare. Margaret O'Brien got beat, even though she did literally everything right from a candidate perspective.
Right.
But Brian Iden managed to pull it out in his House seat. Of course, he doesn't have any in the city of Kalamazoo, right? He's got city of Portage, where he did okay. He's got Texas Township, which is what usually brings it home for a Republican in that district. And so he was able to survive because he didn't have any of the city of Kalamazoo. Folks who had that city in their district who are Republicans, they had a bad time.
So you got to look at down the future then, Kalamazoo, the 6th district, that's got to get Republicans a little weary about what's going to happen there in the future of that district. It's no longer the 7th and the 1st that they're worried about. Now all of a sudden it's the 6th.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that district is probably safe for Republicans as long as Fred Upton's there. But if Fred Upton retires this term going into a presidential year, game on.
You mentioned redistricting. There is some consternation that gerrymandered districts had a role in the fact that the House and the Senate are remaining Republicans. I don't know if Proposal 2, if it were being implemented right now, how much it would change some of these districts, because there are still vast amounts of the state that are 55% Republican, 45% Democrat, right? And unless you turn urban areas into spokes on a wheel, you're not going to get 50-50 districts all over this state.
That's absolutely right. And I think that, you know, some of the way that this ballot proposal was sold was really overblown in terms of taking partisanship out of this. You're not going to take partisanship out of this process. You've got partisans on the commission, you know, that are going to be appointed to the commission. So it's still going to be a highly partisan process. Yeah, I think that there was some impact of the redistricting that was done in 2011 on some of these elections, but relatively small number. There's certainly an impact in Southeast Michigan where there are more voters. Districts are going to be more compact, and so there's more opportunity to play around with exactly where those district lines fall. That's particularly true in the House. In the Senate, a lot of these districts, they just sort of are what they are. You can't gerrymander the Senate district in the Upper Peninsula. You can't. I mean, you can play around a little bit with the 37th Senate District in terms of which counties below the bridge are going to be in it, but that's basically baked into the cake. Ottawa County is going to continue to be its own Senate district, and it's going to be a Republican district because most people in Ottawa County are Republicans. So I do think there's an impact in Southeast Michigan. But, you know, the district that was complained about the most for the longest time after redistricting was in Grand Rapids. Democrats won that district.
And because they turned Kent County into this maze up there to try and reconfigure some kind of Republican district up there. And it didn't turn Republican. And it's not going to be Republican, I don't think, anytime soon. Because Kent County, it seems like, is heading more toward that Democratic column.
Yeah, Gretchen Whitmer won Kent County, which is remarkable in and of itself. I mean, typically your Democratic nominee is going to win the city of Grand Rapids, but they're going to lose countywide. She won pretty easily.
So Tom Steyer across the country spent $15 million to turn out the youth vote. And we saw that here in Michigan through two entities, by and large, NextGen and For Our Future. NextGen concentrating more on the college kids, and For Our Future going into kind of these more high populated urban areas, trying to get people out, get them motivated, get them excited about politics and why they would want to support Democrats. How much of an impact do you think they had as part of this blue wave?
I think they had a very substantial impact, and I also think they're lighting the way forward for Democrats. Outside of brown folks like myself, no group in America is more Democratic than young voters, but they don't show up. Turning out black and brown voters and turning out young people is a winning electoral coalition for Democrats, and they need to invest in that more. It paid big dividends for them here and in a number of other states around the country.
Do you think Tom Steyer is going to run for president?
Unfortunately, I do.
Why do you say unfortunately?
I don't think that taking on the Trump brand with another entitled billionaire is a winning message. I think you look at places where Democrats won in red or sort of reddish purple states, that lights the way forward for you. I think Democrats should be spending a lot of time looking at Sherrod Brown down in Ohio with a message that's tailored to working people, not white working people or black working people, tailored to working people. I think that that's a winning message for Democrats. I think that it can motivate young people who feel like they're on the bad end of the economy, like they're going to grow up with less opportunity than their parents did. I think that's a winning message for Democrats. I don't think nominating another billionaire is the right move for them.
Well, if you nominate a billionaire, though, they can sell finance and they can do whatever they want to as far as a technology standpoint, an outreach standpoint. The resources are endless.
Yeah, no, the resources are endless. I would just point to the 2016 election results. Hillary Clinton had a lot more money in the bank than Donald Trump did, and she lost. Now, granted, I don't think the Clintons are quite billionaires yet, but nominating another sort of upper crust patrician type, I don't think is the right move for Democrats. I think that they need to not necessarily take a more populist approach, but take an approach that's focused a lot more on kitchen table concerns for working people in this country.
One other thing I want to touch on, Adrian, the UAW. You know, for all the stuff that the Democrats did right, the UAW seems to have taken it in the chops not once, not twice, but three times during this election cycle. First, they tried to find an alternative to Gretchen Whitmer. Fail. They tried to get Patrick Miles to be the attorney general nominee. Fail. And now they tried to get Brian Elder to be the House Minority Leader here in Lansing. And that was a fail. What the heck is going on over there?
You know, I think there are a number of things going on in that organization right now, and I'm not a UAW member and I'm not in their leadership, so I don't want to comment too much on this. But what I will say, number one, there's still the federal government probe that's going on at the UAW, and I know that there are a number of folks in leadership that are trying to keep the splashback from that off of them. The whole controversy around the training funds and the fact that, you know, General Holyfield really only escaped the federal investigators by jumping into his grave. So I think that's problem number one. Problem number two, they've got membership problems just in terms of the perception with their membership. That's not helped by the fact that they're building a cabin for their former president up at Black Lake with non-union labor. Makes it tough to motivate the members, get them to go out and do doors, make phone calls, and give additionally of their time and treasure. I think the other thing that has been a struggle for the UAW really since the failed ballot initiatives that brought us right to work in this state has been that the UAW has been perfectly content to be the kingmaker in a minority party. And I think Democrats are largely tired of that. I think even a lot of UAW members are largely tired of that. They want to win some elections now. And so the UAW's brand is not in great shape in Michigan. They've still got a ton of members here, particularly in mid-Michigan. They've still got deep pockets, but they really need to do some serious reorganization in terms of their political operation because they can't keep taking L's like this. You brought up three really bad L's for this election cycle that they've taken, but really this dates back to 2010. The UAW hasn't had a good cycle since then.
Well, in 2012, that was when they put up that ballot initiative to try and get collective bargaining to be part of the Constitution. They lost that, and it's been downhill ever since. Right to work got passed. We had the prevailing wage get repealed. The Republicans have just been using the UAW as a punching bag ever since.
I think that's right, and I think that's part of the reason why you're seeing Democrats, particularly Democratic candidates and operatives, shifting their attention in terms of the labor movement away from the UAW and much more towards the Michigan Education Association, which has got a huge number of members. And they've got members in most counties in the state, including a lot of the politically competitive counties. They also, by the way, have a lot of members that are Republican, and they've been doing a better job year over year of communicating with those Republican members. You're also seeing them turn more towards, you know, unions in the building trades, some other folks like that. The UAW is difficult to get engaged, and when they do engage in election cycles, it's always on their terms. And I don't think that works for a lot of Democrats.
Well, I was just going to say that. I wonder if the UAW needs to be more collaborative with the other unions, because there are a lot of unions here that seem to be doing okay. I mean, you mentioned the MEA, but what about the SEIU and what about AFSCME, or just getting into the building trades, which seem to be maybe in the future? It seems like there needs to be a more collaborative approach here as opposed to this is what we're going to do. It's going to be top down and everybody stand in line.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the labor movement would be very well served by empowering some sort of umbrella organizations. Frankly, I think that the AFL-CIO in Michigan is an underutilized resource. They've got some very smart, very talented people that are working in their political and communication shop over there. And I think that that's an obvious sort of umbrella for the labor movement to organize under, really empower the folks at AFL so that there can be that kind of joint decision-making, the leveraging of resources, and some really strategic investments in grassroots organizing around the state on the terms of the people who live in those parts of the state, as opposed to on the terms of the UAW or some other labor leaders.
Adrian Heeman from Grassroots Midwest, thanks for joining us on the podcast this week.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
I have a blue house with a blue window. Blue is the color of all that I wear. Blue are the streets and all the trees are too.
Joining us now for the podcast is Communications Director for Our Future, an old friend of the program, Josh Pugh. Thanks for being on, Josh.
Hey, thanks a lot, Kyle. I really appreciate being on with you this afternoon.
So, for our listeners' benefit, tell us what For Our Future was. We've written about it before. It's been a heck of an outfit in this past election.
Absolutely. Really, really proud of the work that that our team pulled off in the election. Obviously, you saw that in the results, but since February, we've been on the ground here in Michigan. So we're actually a national nonprofit that has operations in seven states, and Michigan was one of those. But here in Michigan, we built up to over 200 staff, and those staff knocked 1.3 million doors. And so over the course of the last few months on those doors, they had tens of thousands of conversations with voters. And we really aimed to do that, do something a little different. So before the primary, when we didn't have any endorsed Democratic candidates to talk about, what are we going to talk about? Well, we just asked questions. We asked voters, what issues do you care about most? And then we took that data and we used it to inform the lit that we used throughout the rest of the campaign. It informed our digital program. It really was used to help out in all the communications that we did. So we really tried to take that to heart. We found, I think, some interesting things, and we communicated that with the media and publicly as best we could to try and really get everybody on board, all of our allies, to take advantage of that great work that we were doing. And so, may not be surprising, clean water was the number one issue across the state that voters cared about most.
Now, was this Tom Steyer money or union money?
So it was a coalition of groups. Next Gen Climate Action out of San Francisco was on the board, and then a coalition of labor unions from different all different folks from different
spectrums.
Jobs. Yes. So not just you know AFSCME, but AFSCME and the UAW and groups doing all kinds of different things. So.
And so this get out the vote effort, and this is really what it was engaging people and getting them think more longer term about why they're interested in the politics that they're interested in.
Yeah, and the interesting thing was we actually looked at when we looked at who we wanted to communicate with and who we wanted to reach out to, it wasn't just Democrats who are maybe less likely to turn out and vote, which is sort of the traditional model. And it also wasn't people who maybe weren't with us on the issues but were likely to vote, a more typical persuasion universe. It was across the spectrum. So we were talking to those classic Obama-Trump voters. We were talking to labor union members who in a lot of cases were those Obama-Trump voters. And we were talking to what we call the rising American electorate, so single mothers and people of color and young people as well.
The results of the election on Tuesday have to be viewed then in your group as a success, in that you did get out more Democrats than Republicans out to the polls. And in those areas where you focused, which was predominantly the more populous counties in the state, they came out to vote, and they voted in the state legislature, and they voted for Congress.
Yeah, I think what we heard throughout the campaign is that regardless of how the stock market's doing or what the unemployment rate is or what Donald Trump is tweeting or what he's saying about the economy, people really feel that the economy right now is not working for them. They feel that the priorities of the Republican legislature were in the wrong place. And I think that voters really came out and sent a strong message that, again, was really in line with what we've been hearing on doors throughout the cycle.
You guys ended with what, 120 paid canvassers?
We were over 200.
200?
Yep.
How many doors did you guys knock?
So we had 1.3 million attempts. We were a little, that wasn't 1.3 million doors,
sure.
Because if you attempt a household and there are two people there, you know, you're trying to talk to both of those folks, nearly a million doors.
And how many connections did you make?
75,000 over, just about. Obviously those, that continued right up until polls closed yesterday, so I don't have the exact number,
okay.
But yeah, certainly nearly 100,000.
You guys aren't folding up and going home, I take it.
Absolutely. No, we are not.
So what are you going to do now?
Not
campaigning against Trump now?
Not taking our foot off the gas. Actually, if folks can even believe it, the lame duck legislative session is now coming up here at the end of 2018. We expect that to be active. And so we are keeping a large chunk of our full-time staff. We're going to be over 50. We're going to have full-time canvassers on the ground, knocking on doors and re-engaging with voters about, we did it. We got out to vote, and we sent a strong message, and we want to make sure that the legislature that's still around in Lansing is receiving that message.
And you guys are probably kind of tapping into this attitude that people have, which is, you only care about me when you want my vote.
That's absolutely right. We've said since the beginning of 2018 that this was going to be a different kind of operation. We've partnered with a lot of grassroots organizations that were already on the ground in those communities that already had connections, so that we really try in as many cases as we possibly can to have people knocking on the doors of their neighbors, because when someone looks like the area that they're canvassing in, that's when those conversations are going to be most effective. And we really want to continue those relationships and continue those conversations right through December and into the off year next year.
So what is it about this lame duck that For Our Future cares about?
So primarily our concerns are those of an economic nature. Significantly, the minimum wage increase that just passed a few months ago. We're really concerned about the strategy that the Republicans have talked openly about, of this idea that Jim Ananick called the undo and screw, where, you know, they stepped in and took away our right to vote for that just so they can turn around now in December after voters really sent a strong message that this is not an economy that's working for regular people, and they're literally going to step in now, we think, and undo that and take away that benefit that's been already given to people. So with the minimum wage and the paid sick time initiative, we want to make sure that any changes, obviously, hopefully, no changes will be made, but any changes that are made come with as little harm to regular working folks as possible. We also want to make sure that they don't pull the rug out from under the new governor-elect before she is even inaugurated. We saw in North Carolina, after Roy Cooper was elected there, the Republican legislature did everything they could to undermine the governor's powers. And so we've actually been working with partners from North Carolina on adopting the lessons that they learned. And we want to make sure that that there are no departments that are consolidated unnecessarily, and really just anything else that they could possibly do to try and cut the legs out from under Gretchen Whitmer before she even gets a chance to take office.
And so when you're having these conversations with people, do you expect them to be as engaged as they would be during an election season? I mean, when it's kind of a top issue and you know, Trump is on TV and you have a chance to stick it to Trump or support Trump, you're more interested in having those conversations. Are you concerned that there's just going to be a hangover where folks aren't really interested in talking politics anymore?
Well, first of all, one of the really interesting things that we found in the doors is that, you know, voters wanted to talk about clean water. They wanted to talk about fixing the roads. They wanted to talk about fixing their schools. They wanted to talk about healthcare. They didn't always want to talk about Trump. That was out there.
Okay.
But it wasn't even a top five issue anywhere. Although at a deep level, that's certainly an animating factor. It's certainly something that people are cognizant of. It's not even on the top five of issues of the folks that we're talking to. But what I will say is that we are starting as quickly as possible, both because of the weather and because we want to connect with people when this election is still fresh in their minds. So far from a hangover, I would say that people are energized because they voted. We saw record turnout. I don't think anyone who participated in the election could really say that they feel like, you know, their vote doesn't matter, because we saw sweeping gains, historic gains by Democrats at all levels. Now we want to remind people that, like, okay, but we have to, they could still not get the message. And so we really want to do everything that we can to make sure that Republicans in the legislature get that message.
So the election that we just had Tuesday, you would classify it as what? What adjective would you use?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, I think I've told you before, the blue wave was a dirty word around our offices. We really didn't like talking about that. We didn't like, obviously, our staff members reading the polls and thinking that we were ever going to let off the gas. But I don't think there's any way to argue that the gains the Democrats made statewide here in Michigan were historic yesterday. I mean, we saw, if you remember back in the 2012 legislative session, Republicans literally redrew the lines of the Oakland County Commission so that they would have an impenetrable majority there. That was broken yesterday. Obviously, Proposal 2 is going to change districts significantly to be fairer, so that people are more likely to have their voices heard at the legislative level. And frankly, Proposal 3, I mean, that was talk about the sleeper issue of the 2018 campaign. That is going to completely change the face of the electorate in 2020 and beyond. Just even same-day registration. I mean, that's a tactic that we've invested, I would assume, millions of dollars on the progressive and Democratic side over the last several cycles. That's just completely off the table now, because it's there for people and they can take it up whenever they want.
Are you guys going to expand the universe of people that you're talking with, or are you still concentrating in the more highly populated counties?
You mean right now or
going forward
in 2020? So we haven't had those conversations yet, okay. But we're certainly going to take a deep look at what the effects were of our conversations. Obviously, the folks who were going to be canvassing over the next few weeks, that's going to be part of that. Those conversations are certainly going to inform that, because we want to take an honest assessment at sort of what we did and how we did and what actually worked, and throw out the stuff that didn't. But certainly, I think that it was an unprecedented presence. It was something that was really historic on the independent side. The amount of resources and the cutting-edge way that we deployed those resources in really, again, listening to people and having authentic conversations, as opposed to just yapping at them about you need to support this candidate and get out and then moving on to the next door, mm-hmm. was certainly something that we felt was very effective, and we're going to continue into 2020.
Sounds like for our future, maybe a long-term relationship then with some folks.
Like I said, not taking our foot off the gas. It certainly can be exhausting. And we're definitely going to take a couple days this week to catch our breaths and maybe relax a little bit. But it's exhilarating to be in a position where, you know, we've been planning for this lame duck session, as opposed to, say, like a 2012, when really a lot of folks were caught off guard by the extent to which the Republicans went. But back to 2012 really quickly. I mean, what we saw in 2012 was an emergency manager law that had been just undone by the voters was put back into place, and that led to the Flint water crisis. And directly.
We also had right to work repeal.
Exactly, right? Exactly. But so we're looking at history and what's happened in other states and making sure that we don't go through a repeat of that and suffer those consequences again.
Josh Pugh from For Our Future Michigan, thanks for being on the podcast this week.
Thank you, Kyle.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Adrian Heeman for stopping by MERS World Headquarters, and also Josh Pugh for having a conversation with us. And thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.